From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. As the coronavirus death toll and case toll continues to mount in the United States, President Trump says he's eager to get the country back to work.
Millions of Americans are making profound and difficult sacrifices in their own lives because they know it will save the lives of countless others, and that's exactly what it's doing. You see what's happening and where we are, where we stand, and hopefully we're going to be opening up. We can call it opening very, 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 very soon, I hope.
We're going to start this hour with Kimberly Atkins, Washington correspondent for WBUR. Kimberly, the president says he wants to open up the country for business as early as May 1st, even though public health officials warn that may be too optimistic. What kind of pressure is President Trump under to get the economy moving again?
Well, the pressure to reopen the country, as the president says, seems to be coming largely from him. His instinct since the beginning of the coronavirus crisis was to keep the country as open as possible, to dismiss it, and now lately has been to urge the reopening as early as possible. Last week, he was talking about reopening by this Sunday, Easter Sunday. And it's his advisors and other people within the administration that are being much more cautious, saying that these efforts, the distancing efforts that have been put in place, need to stay in place longer. The Surgeon General Jerome Adams just today said that this is going to go on for weeks and months. So it's really putting a doubt on this idea that the country can open by May 1st.
Well, we heard the president say that in one of those daily briefings. That one was from yesterday. He's been doing this every day, coming out and talking to the press. The Wall Street Journal editorial board, typically friendly to the president, wrote about how off-key Trump has become in his daily briefings. Has the way he's been conducting these briefings become a political liability for him?
Republicans increasingly are thinking so. Behind the scenes, they have been urging him to step back a little bit in those briefings and leave it to the experts like Dr. Anthony Fauci from the National Institute of Health and others to really give the updates about what is happening, where in the country we are seeing the outbreaks and where in the country we are seeing improvements. But that, again, is not in the president's nature. He would normally be giving rallies at this time in an election year, and he can't do that. So the podium in the White House has become the replacement for that. And he's finding it very difficult to resist the urge to take over the messaging himself, regardless of what those in his own party want.
What is happening at the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue on Capitol Hill? There's a stalemate now on another stimulus package from Congress. What is the holdup? And do you think lawmakers will eventually find a way to get it done?
Well, the holdup is the difference between Democrats and Republicans when it comes to when the next round of stimulus is coming. They both agree that there needs to be a next round of stimulus. They even agree that when it comes to small businesses, that an additional $250 billion is needed immediately to help the SBA keep up with the small business loans that are being requested right now. The disagreement comes on whether there should be other relief, direct payments to Americans, more things like SNAP benefits, extending medical leave onto that bill. Republicans say wait until the previous stimulus package, those funds have been distributed and that has tapped out before the next move. And Democrats want to act much more quickly.
There is one other disagreement between Democrats and Republicans I want to ask you about. We saw the chaotic situation in Wisconsin this week with the primary, long lines because of coronavirus concerns. Many people thought that primary should have been postponed altogether. And President Trump, without any evidence, called one alternative, which would be voting by mail, corrupt. We should note he voted in the last primary by mail. What is your sense about whether there will be significant changes and a lot more voting by mail come November?
Well, based on what we've heard from other Republicans, including Mitch McConnell, it is unlikely that provisions that would allow for voting by mail would be included in any stimulus package. There's just not the Republican support for that on that front. And when it comes to the president, he claims that there is a fraudulent aspect of voting by mail. His own task force didn't find any evidence of that. So that, again, is one of the fact checks that come out of this, out of these frequent briefings.
Well, and I'm sure that voting by mail is something that is going to continue to come up in these briefings the longer this crisis goes on. Kimberly Atkins, Washington correspondent for WBUR, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's go now to New Orleans, where, like many parts of the country, testing for COVID-19 continues to lag. Orleans Parish has the same number of cases per capita as some of the worst hit areas of New York. Patrick Matten is news director for member station WWNO in New Orleans. And Patrick, I see it's gotten so bad in some areas of New Orleans that the city is now setting up these mobile testing sites for high-risk people in coronavirus hotspots. What's the latest?
Right. So Tanya, the city announced yesterday that they were changing their testing strategy from having this one centralized drive-through location to having these mobile units that are going to go into these neighborhoods that have been hardest hit by the virus. We don't know yet which neighborhoods they're going to go into, but you know, we know here in New Orleans that the virus has had a disproportionate impact on the Black community in terms of deaths. And in terms of overall testing, you know, the state has tested a lot of people, more than 70,000, but the majority of those tests took place in the state's urban centers. And officials also say they want to test more people in the rural areas here in Louisiana, yeah, where the virus appears to be spreading more rapidly.
We've been talking a lot about peaks. Some cities like New York say they appear to be getting near a peak, but the cases are still doubling. We're hearing between every 3 and 5 days in areas around Baton Rouge and New Orleans. What are the projections for a slowdown from health officials?
So, I mean, you know, as you said, this is still a hot spot for this coronavirus fight. We know we've had 18,000 confirmed cases. More than 700 people have died so far here in Louisiana. But there are signs of progress. The governor, John Bel Edwards, said earlier this week that the state doesn't appear to be running out of ventilators, which had been a big concern. Mm-hmm. Last week. And he's also optimistic we may be seeing the beginning of the flattening of this curve, so to speak, in terms of overall cases and hospitalizations.
And the death number, lots of notable people who have passed away, State Representative Reggie Bagalia, as well as New Orleans cultural history icon Ronald Lewis. Thank you so much. That's member station WWNO's Patrick Matten. Now to Spain, which once had the world's second highest coronavirus death toll, second only to Italy. Now there are signs the outbreak in Spain could be past its peak. The BBC's Guy Hedgeco joins us from Madrid. And Guy, we're still talking about hundreds of deaths a day. What are the latest figures from Spain?
Well, the latest figures show that 605 people died from coronavirus over the last 24 hours. Now, that's still obviously a pretty distressing figure, but it is less, for example, than yesterday. And it is noticeably lower than it was even just a few days ago, when the daily death toll appeared to peak somewhere above 900 deaths each day. So in the broader context of the coronavirus crisis in Spain, these latest figures are relatively good. It's certainly the number of new infections as well, that seems to be easing off. There were 4,500 new infections over the last 24 hours. That's lower, certainly, than the spread of the virus, than we were seeing when the spread of the virus was at its peak a week or two back.
You're mentioning a peak. Do public health officials believe this trend will indeed continue, that Spain is really past the peak of this pandemic?
Yes. I mean, the Spanish government has been saying for some days now that it believes that the peak has already hit. Now, Spain has 17 different regions, so the peak appears to have hit, if it is the peak, it appears to have hit at different times. But certainly the overall message we're getting from the government, and certainly from these figures as well, appears to be that the worst does seem to be over. If you look at the overall statistics, the feeling overall is one of cautious optimism.
Christians around the world are marking Good Friday today, but of course there can't be any church services with lots of people or church services at all. What's happening in Spain today?
Well, in Spain, Easter is a huge festival, you know, perhaps more so than many other European countries. It's a really big deal. And obviously this year, that is going to be very different. There are not going to be any of the Easter parades that you tend to see in towns and cities across the country. In terms of church services, people, it depends on where you are, but in some towns there will be church services, but as far as I'm told, if you have to wear special protective equipment, certainly a face mask if you want to attend. So it's a very quiet time in Spain, whereas usually Easter would be, it's a religious festival, but usually it would be, you know, the streets would be full of people, there'd be parades, and it would be a big time of celebration. That's certainly not the case at the moment.
The BBC's Guy Hedgeco speaking with us from Madrid. Guy, thank you so much for this update.
It's a pleasure, Tanya.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. That's why you need Indeed.com. Post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates using an intuitive online dashboard. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free at Indeed.com/here now. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply. Offer valid through March 31st, 2020.
If you're like me, you're one of the lucky ones, able to work from home during the pandemic. But millions of Americans have already lost their jobs, and others are having to go out in public to work, including, of course, healthcare workers, but also delivery drivers. We're going to hear now from two people who are experiencing this pandemic differently, starting with Daniela Humphreys in Austin, Texas. She's a clinical research nurse who was recently laid off. Daniela, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, first of all, let's talk about what it's been like for you to file for unemployment since you have been laid off. A lot of people have had a lot of trouble even getting through and getting the kind of help that they need.
Correct. I haven't been able to apply.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
And how much time are you spending trying to do that?
I kind of limited myself because it was driving me crazy to keep trying. So at first, I really didn't think it was going to be this hard. I started at like 50 calls a day, then I went up to 100, and now I limited myself to 400 times a day, and then I'm done for the day.
Wow. Wow. And what happens when you call? Do you just get a busy signal or what?
Sometimes it's a busy signal. Sometimes it'll ring and then go to a busy signal. Sometimes I'll get all the way through the prompts. It starts asking just the general questions like it does online. And then once it transfers you, because it asks like if it's related to Corona and all of that. And once it transfers you, it'll say that they apologize due to the overwhelming response. Nobody can take your call. They're open on Saturdays and try again.
And what about online?
I don't know. There's an issue online. Some people are able to do it. A lot of the people I work with were able to do it same day and they're already receiving benefits. But when I do it, an error comes up saying that I can best be served by calling the 1-800 number. So I'm not able to. And I don't know what the issue is because I've never been able to speak to anybody.
How long are you going to be able to get by without getting unemployment benefits?
That's a good question. So I've called the bank. I've called the electric company. I've called like all my credit cards, my car. Everybody has pretty much given me a month. The mortgage is an issue because they are giving you a 3-month with no penalty, but the lump sum is due at the end of the 3 months, which if I have no income, there's no way for me to pay. So I'm really not sure like what's going to happen at that point. I have some savings, but right now I'm using that mainly for food and I'm trying to save a portion of my mortgage. I got really, really lucky. And one of my neighbors, her boss called her on Monday and she asked if she knew anybody who had been laid off recently and she's going to pay my mortgage for a month.
Wow. Now you also have a son and a niece living with you.
Correct.
So have you had to cut back on anything when it comes to that?
On everything. Even our groceries, which I didn't realize. I mean, I've been blessed, so I never really had to budget. You know, it was kind of just we get whatever we want, we enjoy it, we go out to eat. Now it's kind of like we have to eat. So I started going through my freezer. We're eating everything that's in the freezer before I have to buy groceries again. I'm trying to go through all the canned foods and things like that. I'm worried about the electric bill because it's going to be pretty high. It's in the 90s now. And so I kind of just close the windows all like during the day. We close the blinds. We try to keep it as cool as possible. And then at night we open everything up to let it cool down again.
Now, what about health insurance? Your employer has agreed to pay your health insurance through this month. But what happens after that?
I won't be insured. And so my son's father, he's going to be able to put him on his insurance because it's a life event. And then for me, I'm not sure, and I have to have insurance. That's another big thing. What I tried to do was refill all of my medications for 90 days for now. I had thyroid cancer, so I can't be without medication. So I at least have that for now, and then I'll just have to figure it out at that point if I get there and I still don't have insurance.
So, Daniela, if there's somebody listening to this, either in Austin, Texas, the state capital there, or in Washington, what would your message be to them right now?
We need help and we need it soon. I worry about other people. I'm lucky that I did have some savings. I think I can make it maybe 6 weeks to 8 weeks without it, depending on what I pay and don't pay. But there are some people who don't have that, and I have no idea how they're eating. Like, we have zero money coming in, and you can't sleep at night.
And you still feel like you're one of the lucky ones?
Unfortunately, yes. I mean, I've heard other stories, and I feel like at least I can buy food, you know? That's like the big thing. We have a roof over our head right now. I don't know what other people are doing. If they have no money, what are they eating? I don't know. And they have families, they have kids who are sick. We're in trouble.
That is Daniela Humphreys, who is a laid-off clinical research nurse in Austin, Texas, who has been trying, like so many people, but unable yet to file for unemployment. Daniela, good luck to you, and thank you so much for talking with us.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate your time. Good luck to you as well.
And now let's turn to Sabrina Lee in Atlanta. She is working through this crisis doing deliveries. She works for DoorDash, Uber Eats, Postmates, and soon to be Instacart and Grubhub. Sabrina, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, that's a lot of places to be working for. How much time are you spending making deliveries?
All day. I start at 7:30 in the morning. Then I take little breaks throughout the day, and then I stop when the sun goes down.
And what kind of precautions are you taking as you do that? Are you wearing a face mask everywhere you go?
Absolutely. I have a bunch of face masks. I buy a few of them every day. So I really don't use the same mask twice, even though you can spray them or whatever. Anytime I get my hands on some gloves, which is rare, I use those. I have hand sanitizer. And I have a spray bottle full of water mixed with bleach that I spray out my bags, my delivery bags.
And when you do the handoff, how does that work with people who are accepting food or whatever you're bringing them?
If they opt for a no contact delivery, I just take it up and set it on their porch, send them a picture of it, and they get it. If they actually want to come to the door and take it from me, I'll set my bag down on the porch, open it up, put hand sanitizer on my hands, then I reach in a bag and hand them their food.
Mm-hmm. Are you worried about, even after all those precautions, that you might get sick as a result of this?
Absolutely.
I hope people are giving you some big tips.
Yes and no. Yes, that's kind of few and far between. People who actually appreciate what we do, but a lot of people are still doing the, oh, well, I'm out of a job and I don't have that much. But, you know, my common sense would tell me if you don't have that much, then go to Aldi's, you know, buy some actual food. But there's sometimes they're being cheap. They do need to up the tips because we're out here doing something that they don't want to do, which is go out in public, pick up food, be around restaurants, open the doors, breathe all of this air. We're out on the front lines also, just like these doctors and nurses.
Absolutely. And you have three kids and you've got a husband also who I understand was laid off from his job as a trucker. Are you making enough through all these deliveries you're doing to support your family right now?
Yes, barely. But yes, I work, you know, he'll get his unemployment, but he's in Ohio right now taking care of my dad. My dad has diabetes. He has to go to dialysis 3 times a week and he's going blind. So he had to go back to Ohio to take care of my dad. So I'm holding it down here at this house, the lights, the gas, since my child is out of school. You know, I got to keep the entertainment on the television. All of that adds up, food. So that's why I have to be out 12 hours a day, every day.
How long do you think this is going to go on?
I believe they're going to keep pushing this stay in the house, shelter in place. Every month they're going to push it back. But then maybe when they get a handle on it, it's going to be October, November again, flu season. I really don't have no clue. I just know that I'm going to work as much as I can until I can't.
Let me ask you one more thing. Are these companies, you say you're working for DoorDash, Uber Eats, Postmates, soon to be Instacart and Grubhub, are they helping you out? Are they doing everything that you think they could be doing to make sure that you're able to do your job safely?
Absolutely not. DoorDash just started sending some Dashers 2 ounce hand sanitizers. They have these gloves that rip apart, but they're sending those out for free. And they're sending us a face mask, but the sides break. They could be doing more. They keep touting this, we can have no contact. Okay, that's fine for the people, but we still have to be around other people in the restaurants picking up the food. They need to up the base pay. The base pay is still $2 and $3. They know that they can help us out. What they do is they say, if you want to apply for unemployment, you can, but it's based on how much you made 3 months ago or something like that. But there's so much red tape and situations behind that. We're not getting paid what we should be getting paid. There's no reason why they asked me to do an 8-mile order for $3. I'm losing money. That's wasting time. That doesn't make any sense. They really can step up because they're multi-million dollar companies.
Well, Sabrina, you're absolutely right. You are on the front lines, just like so many other people right now. So thank you for what you're doing. And I hope that you're able to stay safe and keep making the money that you need to survive through this crisis.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
That is Sabrina Lee, who is working for DoorDash, Uber Eats, Postmates, soon to be Instacart and Grubhub, to support her family through this crisis. She joined us from Atlanta. And let us know how you're doing. Are you working through the pandemic, or have you been laid off? And are you having trouble filing for unemployment, wondering when you will work next? You can tell us at hereandnow.org.
And as many parts of the country brace for more coronavirus patients over the next few weeks, hospitals are trying to get ready. NPR's Patty Naiman talks with administrators at two large hospitals in Los Angeles.
Harbor UCLA Medical Center is a large public teaching hospital. Most of its patients are low income, on Medicaid or uninsured. Chief Medical Officer Dr. Anish Mahajan says he plans to triple the number of beds available to treat critically ill patients.
So we are converting parts of the hospital that are typically wards and other uses into ICU level care.
Which means adding new equipment, heart monitors, oxygen monitors, and ventilators.
We are working very hard on projecting the number of ventilators we need and how many that we have on hand. That said, we know we are short.
They have 50 ventilators now, he says, but they could easily need 100 or more. Ventilators aren't cheap, about $35,000 each. When it's all added up, converting a regular ward bed into an ICU bed costs thousands of dollars per bed. At the large private Cedars-Sinai Medical Center, upgrades are also in the works, converting operating and recovery rooms, for example, into ICU units. And that's only the beginning of extra new costs. Chief Operating Officer Dr. Jeffrey Smith.
We have additional security personnel because we're checking temperatures and monitoring people for symptoms, including not just patients, but visitors and our staff as well.
Then there's the additional staff needed to care for many more patients, which includes doctors, doctors in training, and nurses.
The first thing we did is identified people who have experience caring for patients in the ICUs.
They may not have done it for a while, but
with minimal retraining, we're able to get them up to speed.
At Harbor UCLA, Mahajan says they plan to redeploy doctors and nurses to the ICU if need be.
All of these staff have been directed that we may ask you to work in an ICU-level care setting under the guidance of ICU nurses or ICU doctors, even if that's not what you typically do.
Which means longer hours, overtime, and weekend duty, all new costs. Rick Pollack, president of the American Hospital Association, says this experience is being repeated in hospitals nationwide.
Setting up alternative care sites, very expensive. Putting in the command centers, putting in the security, all very expensive. A lot of extra expense to deal with the situation with very little revenue coming in.
That's because most hospitals have cut back on elective procedures to make room for COVID-19 patients, which means this source of money has dried up. So have payments for care at hospital clinics, since many have been closed to reduce exposure to the virus. It boils down to this: higher costs and less revenue.
Every hospital in this country is suffering right now. The virus is in every single state. We have virtually every hospital that has shut down regular operations. So everyone needs help in this situation.
In the stimulus package recently passed by Congress, hospitals will receive $100 billion. Some of that money is already in the pipeline. It's not yet clear how that money will be doled out or whether harder-hit hospitals will receive more. And ultimately, Pollack says, more money will be needed.
Given the magnitude of what we're facing, it sounds like a lot of money, but we have a lot of need. And we think that since we're on the front lines, we need to be at the front of the line when it comes to getting assistance from the federal government and the Congress.
Not only will more aid be needed to address the current crisis, Pollack says once hospitals rebound and move into recovery, assistance will be critical then as well. Patty Nament, NPR News.
And a break now from the coronavirus for a new book called Final Draft, the collected work of David Carr. The journalist David Carr died in 2015 at 58 years old, and he was admired as a master of his craft. Here he is in 2008 on Charlie Rose talking about his memoir, The Night of the Gun.
If I say, you know, as an addict, I got, I sobered up, got custody of my children, got us off welfare, survived cancer.
Right.
And then got a great job. That's one story. And that's the story I like to tell. But there's another story about somebody who was a full-on maniac, sowed ruin in everyone's lives who he came into contact with, created enormous collateral damage, and either through luck or pluck made it away from that. And both those stories are equally true. I think there's one that makes a little better media narrative, and it's about...
That's a second.
It's about a thug who works at the New York Times.
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
A pretty good reductive piece of analysis. I'd write that story.
Final Draft includes Carr stories on everything from living in a drug rehab center to celebrity profiles to single fatherhood to the media business. The book was edited by Jill Rooney Carr, David Carr's widow, who joins us now. Jill, welcome.
Thank you, Jeremy. Good to speak with you.
Well, and I want to get to the idea of what David Carr would think in this unbelievable moment that we're all experiencing right now. But first of all, let me just ask you why you decided to put together so much of his work into this book.
There was a great deal of material that, you know, David was prolific and he produced so much in his career. And he was a saver. And so although nothing was well organized or necessarily filed or anything like that, it was literally old papers and cardboard boxes and clippings. And once I sort of came through the tunnel of grief and was on the other side, I thought, one, I would like to honor his legacy first and foremost, but also there's so much of his early work that holds up. And a lot of that hadn't been read or seen in years, and much of it wasn't digitized. So putting it in the book form, I thought, would be a good endeavor.
One of the things that's so amazing to me as I read some of his early work, and you're talking about things that he was doing as a reporter in Minnesota, is that he would take on these stories and the empathy would come through so much that it would be a story about a person who was going through something, maybe somebody who'd just been diagnosed with HIV. And David Carr really entered the world of that person and brought that person's story to everybody who was reading.
I think that was one of his very special gifts, and it's rare. Most people have subject matter expertise. David brought enthusiasm and smarts to any subject, everything he worked on, whether it was a cultural piece, a piece about a musician, a captain of industry. He really zeroed in with people quickly and well, and people responded to that.
How did you go about deciding which pieces would go in here?
I read everything. It took a while, and I pretty much just chose the best of the best.
So give me an example. Do you have one that you could read a little bit of it to us?
Sure. I will read you three paragraphs of a piece entitled Breaking Away, But by the Rules. It ran August 29th in the New York Times, 2003. Every summer for the last 3 years, my family has left our home in suburban New Jersey for weekends at a camp in the southern reaches of the Adirondacks in upstate New York. Our getaway, a cabin with a tin roof but nice wood floors, is framed by a low-slung mountain rising over Jenny Lake, a glorious little spring-fed oasis. To buy the camp, we sought and obtained membership in the Tuiskaroo Association, which governs our part of the lake. In an official history that was written in 1976, to celebrate the 50-year anniversary of Tuiskaroo, there are two divergent translations of the name, Bright and Sparkling Waters or Place of Chilly Winds. But when I bought the place from a friend and I asked where the name Tuiskaroo came from, he had another explanation. Oh, that's Iroquois for lake of many rules, he deadpanned. The rules are mostly common sense, but strictly observed, as if a children's summer camp had suddenly been invaded by mature, scrupulously careful Eagle Scouts. The rules begin with there being no motors allowed on the lake, a glorious one that, and then descend through a litany of evils that include fishing or boating in the swimming area, clearing trees without board's permission, and listening to Eminem or any other amplified music on the beach.
What do you think when you read that now?
Well, it makes me happy because it not only is it clever and amusing, but it reminds me of those very days.
You can hear his voice as you read that. I mean, I met him once, had a chat with him. I've certainly heard him talking before. And as I was reading this, I would hear his voice in just about everything that I was reading.
Absolutely. Very distinctive. So well-toned. Humor often is featured. It makes me happy to read it.
There's one passage in here that I want to read, which he's talking about his own battle with cancer. And he ends this piece by saying, my doctors tell me that I am free of cancer, but that's not really true. When I catch an image of myself in a mirror, it is apprehension, not vanity, that is reflected. The frightful alien in my dreams is now in remission. And if he returns, he will be in a form I now recognize. He will look like me, except he will have cancer. Just an amazing way of putting that.
It is. And his own life experience informed his work and how he told a story and showed you. And that's so valuable. And I think that had an influence and informed how he dealt with everyone that he wrote about.
He talks a lot about his own battle with addiction and the recovery.
Right. You know, it was important for him to maintain his sobriety by saying it and not hiding it and not, you know, sort of acting like that was a different him and a different part of his life. It was very much a part of who he was.
David Carr is no longer with us, but he did serve as a mentor to so many journalists, including Ta-Nehisi Coates, who writes a foreword in this book. Tell us a little bit about some of the journalists that can carry on some of his legacy now.
Oh, some of the folks along the way that David had strong relationships with were Eric Wemple, Amanda Ripley, Brian Stelter, just mm-hmm. to name a few.
And what do you think he taught them?
He taught them, you know, specific elements of the craft, but also the human side of it and what it means to stick to a story. And, you know, he would frequently say, show, don't tell. So do your job and do it super well. And you got to be the human, too.
You know, speaking of being the human, I have to say that one of the things that really stuck out to me in this book is he did a sort of a review of the Acela Amtrak train back in 2001. And he starts it off with a family of train enthusiasts with two little kids who are going every day to watch the Acela come through, and they're so excited about it. I just thought that was such an interesting way to start that story.
Yes, I agree. And if you were to ask me, you know, to tell you my favorite selections in the book, that's chief among them. It was both an interesting story about transportation, its failures, and he painted a picture. You could totally picture yourself being on that train.
Yeah, exactly. And it makes me think that it's not as good as I sort of think of it today, because it is the fastest one. But I mean, he really does not paint it in a very nice light.
Right. And there again, that's an example of that was something he knew nothing about, right? He knew nothing about the train infrastructure and so on. And look what we learned from that. It was amazing.
What do you think David Carr would think of what we're all going through right now?
I think he'd have could relate to what's going on right now on many levels, both personally, health-wise, but probably most importantly, I think he'd want to continue to drive the message that now more than ever, we need the voice of good journalists, the integrity, the purpose. But he actually had this way of seeing around the corner. So I think he'd be writing something that none of us have even thought of yet.
That is Jill Rooney Carr, who is the widow of journalist David Carr and the editor of a new book of his work. It's called Final Draft, The Collected Work of David Carr. Jill, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeremy.
You can read an excerpt from the book at hereandnow.org. The book also includes the course syllabus for David Carr's class at Boston University, in which he tells students, quote, "Your professor has a lot of ideas about a lot of things, some of which are good. We will figure out which is which together."
Millions of us are stuck indoors, and a lot of us are home alone, and it can get lonely after a while, which is why some folks are now finding so-called quarantine buddies. They cook, share meals, watch movies, work out together, and in return for the health of everyone, each person in the group agrees not to see or interact with others, creating, in effect, alternative families. We caught up with four single friends who are doing this in Los Angeles, and two of them, Nati Vogel, a songwriter, and Laurel Penny, a television writer, join us now. Welcome.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, Tanya.
I'm very excited to talk with both of you. I first learned about this because you all were profiled in the LA Times, and I thought, wow, people are really getting creative. You got to tell me the story behind this idea, how it works for you two and your two other quarantine buddies, Pam Schaefer and Sam Braslow.
It's been kind of fabulous, actually. I could walk you through, like, just a day, like even yesterday, you know, Lori and Sam went over to Pam's to all work on their various projects. Sam on a piece, a journalistic piece, Lori on, I think, a pilot, and Pam was doing therapy, and I was at home working on a song commission. And the commission was, you know, moms who can't wait for their kids to go back to school when this is all over.
Yeah, I need this.
I'll send it to you when it's done. I think I should be finished with it later this afternoon. And then Sam and Pam and Lori all come over. I'm on a Zoom call with my, like, weekly Monday gay poker group. And immediately we decide, you know, we miss our local gay bar. And there was a live drag queen lip sync off contest. Lori was like, give me 2 minutes. And you know, they went into their room and they came out in full gorgeous drag. And of course, it was too late to sign up. But then we decided we'd do a photo shoot anyway and a little shoot.
You and, guys are having a ball.
To... you know, we are trying our best.
I want to ask you, is this arrangement also risky? Because Pam and Sam don't live with you. What safety measures do you all have in place? What are the house rules?
Basically, with the four of us, it helps to feel like we're all responsible for the rest of us, because practically speaking, if one of us gets sick, all of us are going to get it, even if we don't have symptoms. If Pam goes out or if I go out and we don't have gloves and a mask, which we're all trying to use as much as possible right now, then it's like any of us went out without gloves and a mask. None of us have within 10 feet contact with anyone else. We share grocery shopping quite a lot. We go to each other's houses and in the car between each other's houses, and sometimes on walks or to the grocery shops. And that's it.
You know, these are very heavy times, and a lot of people are feeling afraid. A lot of people are lonely. And the part of your story that I think resonates with so many folks is that you all felt empowered to build a family on your own as a means of survival, but also as a means of support and to be able to share this joy together in these trying times. Lori, what have you learned about yourself?
I'm all right with being cooped up because, you know, I've been a freelance writer for about 10 years and being cooped up in a room is kind of how I do. It's my default. But being in intense close contact with four people and not being able to reach anyone else and all the normal parts of life being taken away, everybody's got stuff they're worried about. Everybody's worried about money and work coming in and, like, my family. I'm thousands of miles away from my family and I don't know when I'm going to be able to see them again. And it's scary. And I don't know what I would do without these guys around, frankly. And I feel very, very, very lucky that this has happened.
You know, in the end, it really boils down to trust. You all trust each other. So we kind of learning from this kind of arrangement that you have. It really helps to retain our humanity through mutual aid and care.
Of course. You know, it's so interesting that you said that because it's something that we've struggled with, too. And that hasn't come easily. And I just want to say for anybody out there, like, we have to continually have conversations. Like, every time someone in the group, like, talks about potentially breaking quarantine or adding a new person to the group, like, I paralyze. And I'm like, can we talk about this at another time when we're all breathing? Like, we do have to really work at it. And, like, as a gay man, I understand that really well because, obviously, like, you know, my people are no stranger to viruses and all the pathological issues surrounding trust, like, related to that. And I think it's very much like having three partners in that way. Like, it's, you know, it's not always smooth sailing and we always have to negotiate our boundaries, but fundamentally every day is a new opportunity to recommit to taking care of each other.
That's Nati Vogel and Lori Penny, two LA creatives choosing to live as quarantine buddies with two other friends. Thank you all again for sharing your story with us.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thanks so much for reading this story with so much warmth and humanity.
And you heard Nati say earlier, he was writing a song about moms who can't wait for their kids to go back to school when this is all over. Well, he sent it over to me a little while ago, and here it is.
I'll ask nicely, can somebody get mama a drink?
Here and Now is a production of WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.